Hello, and welcome to the Steve Barclay Ponders Out Loud podcast. Instructional coaches and leaders create the environment that supports teachers to continually imagine, grow, and achieve. They model an excitement for learning that teachers in turn model for students. This podcast is dedicated to promoting the important aspects of instructional leadership. Thanks for listening. School as a learning organization for students and staff. I'm excited today to have Frances Valentine from New Zealand on our podcast. Frances is an educator, innovator, technology futurist, and the founder of the Mind Lab and the Tech Futures Lab. And I'm currently reading her new book and thoroughly enjoying it and recommend it to you, Future You. Welcome, Frances.
It's great to be here, Steve.
Would you start by telling us a little bit about the Mind Lab and the Tech Futures Lab?
Sure. Both of them are graduate schools. So we work with professionals of all fields, but a lot of them are education specialists or teachers, right through to people who work in corporate offices. And they are looking towards the future with this idea of how do they get the skills they need today, given their jobs and roles and responsibilities have changed so much. So we teach across technology, sustainability, disruption, and really looking at digital as it changes the roles that we do.
I'm just wondering, as I'm listening to you, how did the pandemic fit into that? These programs were up and going prior to pandemic?
Thankfully, they were. I think particularly for our teachers, we had already taught over 10% of the teaching workforce here in New Zealand before the pandemic hit. And so we knew that at least 10% of the teaching workforce were going to be ready and able to teach online. But certainly it's been a very busy couple of years as more and more people have realized that this new world of digital and online is a big part of the future.
So I pulled the phrase learning organization for our conversation. I wondered if you'd give me a description of how you would define a learning organization.
Look, I think any organization that is going to thrive in today's world has to be a learning organization, which means that they are constantly looking to the future needs and capability, but actually understanding the skills that are needed to keep evolving over time. And so, like individuals, if you stand still for too long and become stagnant, actually it's very hard to get back moving again. So a learning organization is one that is just constantly moving forward slowly and changing over time, adapting and adopting as circumstances around them change. And I think it's a really key attribute of all successful businesses, because not only does the world change and the technologies, but so do the demographics around us. You know, as we get older, the divide between ourselves and young people also changes. So we have to understand them, but we also have to look forward to, you know, looking at the generations ahead of us. And so there are many different, these levers of change, as we call them, you know, things that are around us, which are really changing how we think about the way we work and live and entertain and communicate. But actually, the heart of it is learning. If you learn and you're curious, you can always move as the world changes around us.
So it's the individual's learning that drives the learning organization?
Well, I think the individuals are part of the ecosystem. So there's actually two levels. There's the individual who learns as part of the organization, and then there's the ecosystem of it. If you have a critical mass of individuals, then you have a whole ecosystem that's moving, or an entire organization moving. And so, and sometimes that's even connected with externals. It could be they're part of communities which are also moving. You know, they can sort of tag along, so to speak. So it's, you know, it's at all levels, but it starts with an individual.
In your book, you share an example of a gentleman. I think you described him as a neighbor who had a change in. He's been made redundant, and he sensed that he was at the spot that he couldn't learn the new things that he needed to learn.
What was amazing about that situation was he's 55, very talented guy. The company made him redundant, and they gave him two opportunities as part of his redundancy. One was to have his CV professionally curated by someone who could help them. And the second one was the ability to go and reskill and go into training with no actual cost limitations. So it could have been an executive program, could have been a degree, a master's program. It could have been a pottery class for all it mattered. but he chose not to do anything. He just said he was too old at 55 to keep learning and saw that as a negative, that it was going to reflect on him badly, that he had to go back and actually sharpen the tools, you know, in terms of his trade. And, you know, it was interesting because even a few months later when I caught up with him, he was still looking for a job.
Yeah.
And I just felt, what a lost opportunity, and how we are self-limiting by this idea that at some stage in life we've learned enough. You know, we've never learned enough. There's always more to discover.
Well, that story jumped out at me because as I've shared, retirement age has come and gone for me. And part of the reason that I just don't see that in my near future is that it seems to me there's too much to learn. And it's a whole lot easier for me learning while I'm engaged and working. As such, it causes me to have the conversation with you today, which is part of driving my continuous learning. You know, if I wasn't working at doing this, I wouldn't be having this conversation with you.
It's interesting. Within both my organizations, we have scholarships for over 60s. So people over 60 who get full 100% tuition scholarships, and they are some of our most popular scholarships that we have. Love that. And what happens within a cohort of students, where you have an average student of somewhere between 35 and 40, having somebody over 60 or a few people over 60 in the cohort is just magic, because they bring a whole breadth of life experience to the conversation, which others can't have. So, you know, we really love it.
And history.
And history is great.
They can talk about the technologies that the other people in the room don't know what they are. Kind of both the young and the old both could talk about a technology that the other side doesn't know what it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So what should students be experiencing in a school that's functioning as a learning organization for kids?
I think any student, regardless of your age or stage in life, if you are a student, you are there to expand on what you already know. So if you're reinforcing what you already know because you can easily discover it on Google, then actually it's probably not a great learning experience. So a lot of it is saying the sum of parts is a collective of all the people in the room. So a learning organization or a great school is one where you're learning equally from your peers and from the projects that you collaborate on, and not so much just from the individual, the teacher at the front of the classroom. And a great workplace does the same thing, that it says, okay, let's bring as many people together and problem solve as a collective, because actually you're bringing in the expertise of many and also the viewpoints. And one big part of learning is also stopping the things you no longer need. And I think one of the challenges teachers have is knowing when you're delivering a class and content that you know is now out of date. It's no longer relevant. You cannot contextualize it in today's world. To continue to teach that, unless of course it is history, then to continue to teach that is actually not utilizing the time of learning. You know, we want to make sure we can go, wow, I can use that information. I can see how that fits in my life. Gosh, I can really benefit from that knowledge. But I know there's still a lot of learning out there where people go, where's the context and why are we learning this? Because it just feels like it's either antiquated, outdated, or irrelevant. And I think those are the things where learning becomes difficult, and it becomes, you know, where you lose people, you lose the love of learning if you're learning things you can't contextualize.
So in effect, the school as a learning organization needs to be almost in a continuous state of change, and part of that change being driven by the learners as well as the educators.
I think you need to always have the learners at the heart. They have to be at the heart of every conversation. But there is a self-editing process. You know, we do it in our lives. You know, we decide, actually, there are things that we no longer need. You know, we replace over time. We gift and to charities. We do things. You know, we need the same context. It's like, what is no longer fit for purpose? Let's take that away. Let's bring in that space the things that are now really relevant. And I think this sort of editing is really important, not only on an individual level where we we edit out the things we know are no longer true. I mean, there are so many scientific principles or mathematical things that if you continue to use what we thought was true 20 years ago in today's world, we'd realize we're very much have been outmoded by new information. And I think it's the same thing within the education system. If you are a student or a teacher, it's this personalized view of how do you edit this out. The other thing I think is really important is not to learn the thing you already know. Now, that's either because some people like to show they're clever, so we'll just, you know, I can show you, I know these things, which you already know it, or because actually the teacher hasn't replaced the information. And so they are basically reiterating things they learned the year before. And so there is no stretch on the learning.
It was probably 30 years ago that I told the stories when I was working with teachers that if I were to look back when I was in high school and my teacher had 180 days of a one class period, my history teacher couldn't get to modern times. And 30 years later, that history teacher still has the same number of minutes and the kids in front of him and 30 more years to cover. So if he's not figuring out some change process, you're getting further and further behind every year.
Maybe he needs to start with current time and go backwards.
Exactly. That whole structure didn't fit. But it was the way the texts were laid out then, and the program and the standards.
But this is where I really love classrooms. You know, I'm a great fan of this idea. If you took the same history teacher, and they said, okay, we have this many centuries or decades, whatever it might be, to cover. We have this many days as a class. Which ones do you want to focus on? Let's get some kind of consensus around this. So let's go through this journey of actually saying, okay, let's get all the questions and we'll put some weighting on them and we'll start with the things that everybody wants to do and we'll interject these throughout the year. And the ones that no one's really interested in, let's just not do them. You know, if you're the one person in the class that really wants to understand that, there's a whole lot of learning opportunities for you to go and self-learn. That's an easy thing to do. You know, so if rather than actually just saying we're going to do all of it and we're going to squash the last little bit in the last 5 minutes of the year, start by that conversation about saying, let's cover up all the things. And even by creating the list of things that they want to cover, they're learning because people are going, wow, what's that? What's that dynasty? I've never heard of that before. Or did the Romans, what Romans? You know, so you know, or whatever it might be, or what civil war are you talking about? So I think it's really about discovering the interests of a group. And a classroom is a perfect place to do that, because everybody's there for the purpose of learning. So, you know, it's an easy audience to say, okay, blank piece of paper, where are we going to start? Let's get the list on the ground or on the board, or probably on the laptop, I should say.
Just a real quick connect. I went crazy the first time I started teaching graduate level teacher ed classes. And they would look at my syllabus and they'd want me to lay out 13 weeks and what we would be doing each of the 13 weeks. And I, my immediate response was, I haven't met the class yet. So until I know who it is that's enrolled in this course, I understand there's a set of standards, there's a chunk of knowledge they have to walk away with, but it's got to be designed with the people who are in the class in mind. So for me to lay out 13 weeks when I haven't met the people yet, just it didn't make any sense. And the best I got was 2 weeks. they give me the first 2 weeks of class to get it laid out and submitted. But so that really rings to me when you laid that out.
Yeah, and we also now know today how many different learning styles there are. So if it's all one to many and it's the only style they use and it's all from a textbook, well, you've just lost half the class, no matter how good the information is. You know, without having group work or, you know, practical kind of assessments or assignments, or where you've got the ability to discover and things in different ways. And, you know, if you're not looking at different learning styles, then actually the unfair advantage of those who are really academic and great memories will always win. Yeah. And you'll lose those who are highly creative and innovative, but they like to see things either visually, or they like to work on projects together, or they want some time to draw it out and do diagrams and think it through and sort of mind map. So, you know, I think all those things, now that we know them, we have to apply them. You know, it's part of the role of being a great teacher or a great parent, to be fair,
yeah.
is actually understanding that, you know, everybody learns differently. And I know that even with my my staff, that I have a different learning relationship with my different members of staff, depending on how they like to learn and you know, actually come into new information or new skills and the acquisition of new talents. You know, some of them are just naturally curious and they'll pick and jump into everything that's put in front of them. And some are reluctant. And then you have to figure out why, and you work through the process of the type of learning. And it comes back to a pottery class. You know, for some people, learning is just give me something tactical to go and work on for a little while, and I'll learn that way, as opposed to going in and asking me to sit into a class, a language class, when I've got no interest in language, for example.
Mm-hmm. The first chapter in your book is on embracing change. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the first chapter, but I know you wrote about embracing change. And the listeners to this podcast who are school leaders and instructional coaches in school frequently have the role of leading those changes or supporting those changes. So I'm wondering if you'd talk a little bit about the concept of embracing change.
Well, I think humans have a wonderful ability to adapt. And actually, for the majority of things that we get to do, they're really rewarding, whether it's learning you know, an instrument, or going parachuting, or eating a meal you've never tried before. You know, for the most part, the things that we have the ability to try, we get rewarded because they're actually enjoyable. And yet, if we have one or two experiences where we try something and it doesn't feel very comfortable or it feels difficult, we often overly weight that one negative experience across the potential of all the good things. And so you might have somebody who's trying to learn a language, for example, and struggling compared to their peers, and they feel like they're flying ahead and they're still struggling with the basics. So then they like throw their hands up and say, well, I'm kind of done with learning this whole change thing, and, you know, learning a new technology, too hard, I don't want to do it. You know, I learned last year's flavor of the month, and I learned Google Docs last year, and now you're asking me to use Trello boards. What do you mean? I've done it. I've had enough. But actually, the pursuit of change and actually adopting new ways of trying things is one of the most rich experiences we can have as a human. And it's the one that takes us traveling. It's the one that has us, you know, trying different foods or listening to different music, or the one that engages us in a conversation with someone you meet at the bus stop. It's that ability to go, this is a new input, which, you know, it gives me that sense of either accomplishment or information or warmth, because we're rewarded because suddenly we're open to this new profound or different views. All of those things actually are part of growing. And it doesn't matter how old you are. It's this idea that there is no finite part of your brain that says, okay, we've done enough, time to close shop and actually not experience those changes. And so for me, it's about saying, what are the changes that you are limiting in your life? Like, what have you already just decided that you're not prepared to do that could reward you so dramatically in terms of your ability to connect with others, to combat some of the fears that come with changes that you don't expect? You know, we've all experienced COVID. We didn't expect that. And yet we're starting to build that resilience to understand that now we can see a way through. And we will and continue to experience things which you don't plan for. But the more comfortable we are, the more, you know, the more we're going to learn from those experiences. And eventually, when you get really good at change, you actually embrace things that, you know, that come at you sometimes out from the unexpected, but you can see the benefit from it. So if someone turns up at your house and it's no longer a catastrophe, you invite them in and you feel like, this is great. I've got a conversation with someone who I didn't know yesterday or haven't seen for a while.
I want to try my words that came to my mind as I was listening to you. That discomfort of change is almost a signal of an excitement that the learning's about to occur.
Perfect. Yep. I love that. And if, you know, if you thought about the idea that if I said to you, we're going to have a shared dinner, a potluck dinner together with a bunch of friends, if we said, but instead of bringing the dish that you absolutely love to make because you've made it a million times before, how about you just bring some ingredients along? and we'll all look at the ingredients and we'll go, let's make something we've never made before. You know, how much more enjoyable would that be as a collective to collaborate together and say, right, what do we do with these ingredients? And let's find some recipe books, or let's just kind of work it as we go. We'll figure it out, compared to this idea of doing the same thing. Here's another meatloaf dish. You know, here's another bolognese. So, you know, I think we should look for the opportunity all the time to do something a little bit different.
There's a phrase I use in my coaching work that you're looking to create an organization where people are comfortable with discomfort. And what I mean by that is it's that discomfort of change. I recognize that it's uncomfortable, but I'm comfortable understanding that that's what creates the opportunity. And in many ways, I see that's the job of the teacher in the classroom, to create that environment where kids are comfortable with just, if there isn't some discomfort, there's nothing generating that curiosity or risk-taking that's critical to learning. I saw somebody who can produce something I can't produce, and that's challenged me, and that's pushing me into that learning. It's uncomfortable. It'd be easier to walk away, but I know that going through that discomfort is what's going to take me to that learning opportunity.
Yeah, and look, Steve, I think, you know, if you refer back to my book, you know, I talk about when I left New Zealand to head to London at the age of 17, the other side of the world. You know, it's a 26-hour flight to get there. But I didn't have a cell phone because there was no such thing. There was no internet. There was no credit card. And I think in today's world, students have so many safety nets. And in fact, you know, if you're going to be traveling across town to a suburb you don't know, the first thing you do is you Google Map it, and it tells you, the algorithm tells you the fastest way to get there. But what if the scenic route was actually going to give you more reward and enjoyment? And so a lot of the efficiency we've built into life is that telling us what to do next, and the expectation of we want to get there the fastest way or the most efficient way. And I think meandering, and sometimes just having an ability to do it differently, stopping in a different shop, you know, going to a different restaurant, you know, meeting with a different group of friends that you haven't seen for a while, all of those things are about extending, our humanness, and actually saying, these are the things, if we kind of stir it up in our minds about this idea that change is a really great thing and extremely rewarding, then the next time we get in the car, we don't put it into Google and say, you know, take me to the next town. It's actually, you're just going to drive. We have a name for it here in New Zealand. We call it a tiki tour. It's like, let's just do a tiki tour, which means we won't have a particular way of getting there. We'll just find our way there, and we'll arrive when we arrive.
I like it. I like it. Before we wrap up, I introduced to you one of the phrases as a technology futurist. So I'm just wondering, before we sign off here, what should educators be dreaming about as could be around the corner?
Look, the one thing at the moment that I'm spending far too much time trying to get my head around is the metaverse, and this idea that we are moving into this sort of this virtual world that combines with our real world. And there are now these platforms where you can have your avatars, you can hang out, you can do class. There are many schools now developing programs where you're physically having avatars talking, interrelating in a virtual classroom. But instead of being yourself, you're an avatar. And people can go shopping, and you can buy things in this virtual world, and then they're physically delivered to you. But you can also buy virtual, you know, virtual clothing or virtual shoes, and they're only ever stay virtual. You know, it's this whole space where you've got the next step away from having a class on Zoom is going to be a class in a classroom, but in the virtual world. And it's not something that's 5 years away. It's happening today. But obviously, like everything, a technology, it starts with young people first. You know, they're very adept at going into digital first, and you know, it's the extension of people who have played games and esports and all this sort of world. But actually, within 5 years, we will have entire universities, we will have tourism experiences. And in fact, I saw today that they're now going to be having real movies played inside the metaverse. So you'll be able to go and watch the latest movie in a virtual world, sitting in a drive-in movie theater. So, you know, for me, it's always interesting thinking about what comes next. it's not easy. You know, I'm not young, but actually this discovery for me is half the enjoyment. It's like trying to get my head around it, and I'm trying to be in there and going, I can see where this is going. And that's really important.
Terrific. Would you tell listeners how they can find out more about the work that you're doing and connect with you?
Sure. So the two organizations are techfutureslab.com or themindlab.com. And then Frances Valentine on LinkedIn or Instagram. The tricky thing with my name is it's Frances with an E and Valentine, just like Valentine's Day, but instead of the E in the middle, it has an I. A little confusing, but we'd love to hear from you.
Terrific. We'll put all that in the lead into the podcast so folks can go back and find it online.
Perfect.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to Steve Barclay Ponders Out Loud on iTunes and Podbean. And please remember to rate and review us on iTunes. I also want to hear what you're pondering. You can find me on Twitter at Steve Barclay, or send me your questions and find my videos and blogs at barclaypd.com.